Up next, we have Jacob Smith. Jacob Smith is an assistant professor in radio, television, film department at Northwestern University. In addition to writing the books Vocal Tracks, Performance and Sound Media, Spoken Word, Postwar American Phonograph Cultures, and The Thrillmakers, Celebrity, Masculinity, and Stunt Performance. Jacob has also published articles on media history, sound, and performance.
Thank you. Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here. My friend and mentor, Patrick Feaster, has long urged me to come to the ARS conference, and it just hasn't worked out for one reason or another. So I'm really happy to finally be here this year. Make sure I've got this. Okay. It doesn't sound very much like an insect, does it? Asked the author of a 1928 article in Nature magazine, referring to the great soaring tone of Enrico Caruso's matchless tenor. Aware that many readers were probably scratching their heads at this odd question, the author quickly revealed his motivation for asking it. At the bottom of Caruso's phonograph records was, in fact, an unassuming, short-lived, tiny, reddish-colored insect. That is, Caruso's phonograph discs were, not too long before, gum-like lumps on the twigs of a far-off forest, the life work of a little mite, hardly half a pinhead in size. The Nature author marveled at the strange agencies of modern invention and industry that had allowed this humble child of nature hidden away on the other side of the world to catch and hold the sounds that listeners found delightful. That little mite was the Indian lac insect, and the gum-like lumps were composed of a material secreted by the lac insect called shellac, a non-toxic bioplastic that was the key ingredient in most of the phonograph discs manufactured before the mid-1940s. I became interested in shellac as I began to look for ways to begin an environmental perspective, bringing that to the study of sound media. As a result, I want to tell a different kind of story about the American record industry between the 1890s and the 1940s, a story in which lac insects and Indian workers are just as important as Western recording stars and industrialists, and in which ecological models are just as relevant as technological ones. Historians have tended to subdivide the first half century of the phonograph business in two ways. First, a historical demarcation is made based on the various disc formats marketed to consumers. First, shellac discs that spun on 78 RPM, and then long playing records that spun at either 33 1/3 or 45 RPM. A second historical division is based on the type of technology used in the recording and playback of sound. There was an acoustic era of recording horns and spring-wound motors, and then there was an electric era of microphones and loudspeakers. If we take the field that represents the period of the 78 RPM shellac disc, and the field that represents the period of acoustic recording and playback, and align them as a Venn diagram, the overlapping field in the center is the domain that I want to call the era of green discs. The discs of this era were green because they were produced through the labor of both human and non-human actors, required little electricity and so left a minimal carbon footprint, and were made from a reusable, non-toxic, biodegradable bioplastic taken from a potentially sustainable source. My ultimate goal in mapping this green disc network is not to chart a nostalgic return to the past, but to sketch the possible future of more sustainable kinds of phonography. In the longer version of this talk, I discuss aspect of that green disc network in terms of weight and pulley motors in acoustic era studios, hand-cranked playback machines, and biodegradable fiber needles like cactus needles. And I'm really hoping I can talk to some people here who I'm sure know much more about that than me over the course of this conference. Today, I will map only one small area of that topography. And our journey begins not in the grooves of the record, but in the groves of the Indian trees that served as hosts to that humble child of nature, the lac insect. Lassiferlacca is a scale insect that lives in the forests of India, Thailand, and Burma. The life history of the lac insect begins when 200 to 500 larvae emerge from their mother and swarm over the branches of a host tree. The mass emergence of the larvae is the source of the insect's name. The term lac derives from the Sanskrit numeral lac, which means 100,000, and refers to the large numbers of these swarming bugs. After several days of wandering about, the young insects select a suitable location on one of the tender shoots of the tree and settle close together. Each insect pierces the bark of the tree with a long proboscis and proceeds to suck the plant's sap. The sap provides nutrition to the growing insect, but some of it is exuded from glands in the lax body as a golden secretion that forms a coating around the creature and protects it from predators and weather. The insects spend most of their lives under this amber shield, and because they're crowded closely together, the hardened resin forms a continuous layer that covers the branch. And this is a picture that I took at the National Institute for Resins and Gums in Ranchi, India, where they have a little farm of the trees and the bugs here, and they're trying to preserve the industry. The resinous encrustations left behind by the lac life cycle become the raw material for the Indian shellac industry, which was concentrated in the northern states of Bihar and Jharkhand. In the early 20th century, traditional shellac manufacturing provided income for somewhere between 1 and 4 million poor tribal people in northern India. The industry was based on the ownership of lac-bearing trees, which were rented to cultivators called rayats. An important function of these laborers was to maintain the health of the trees. They had to prune and fertilize them to ensure the healthy flow of rising sap and growth of the tender young twigs that the insects liked. In addition to forest husbandry, shellac workers were breeders of tiny livestock and carefully observed the female lac insects for indications that they were due to give birth. Lac-encrusted branches, or brood lac, were then transported to the branches of other trees. And there you can see they're tied onto the tree there to infest the other tree. In this manner, the rayats could monitor the extent of lac infestation on any given tree, an important task given that host trees had poor health, few leaves, and often lacked flowers and fruit. In other words, the rayats were required to be stewards of the forest ecosystem in order to ensure the sustainable production of resin. Branches that were coated with resin were known as stick lac, and they were sent to manufacturing at small village operations that used traditional tools to transform stick lac into a marketable commodity. The first step was to scrape the resin off the sticks to produce what was called seed lac. Seed lac was then taken to washers who stood in a stone vessel and washed it with their feet. Washed seed lac was given to workers who placed it in a long tubular bag and twisted it over a charcoal oven called a bata. A melted mass oozed out of the bag and onto a stone slab, and a worker called a bilwaya stretched the hot mass into thin 4-foot square sheets by holding it with their toes, hands, and sometimes teeth. These large sheets were dried and cooled and then cut into shell-like shapes, hence the designation of the finished product as shellac. Accounts of shellac manufacturing in Western publications reveled in the ways in which workers transformed these raw materials, and lots of pictures of the bilwaya, which suggests an element of a kind of Orientalist fascination with the workers in this what seemed to be a kind of quaint or fascinating pre-modern labor. Indian shellac manufacturing was not simply pre-modern, however, but was simultaneously traditional and modern. Traditional to the extent that it was small-scale production that lacked precise standardization and modes of scientific efficiency, but modern because it created a quintessentially modern material, one of the first mass-marketed plastics. The creation of that plastic material was a crucial component of the network of recorded sound, which we might re-describe in ecological terms. That's one of the nice things, I think, about bringing these other workers and actors into the story. Lac insects were part of an energy cycle in which sunlight was translated into tree sap and tree sap into resin. Human workers continued that process of translation, transforming brood lac into stick lac and then to seed lac and then to shell lac. In these regions of the green disk topography then, what circulates is a form of matter that remembers its previous existence as energy by maintaining the plasticity of that earlier state. When we move from Indian forests to Western recording studios, we find another kind of transformation, one that Jonathan Stern has defined as transduction, the process by which audible vibrations are changed into another form, like the grooves on a phonograph disc. In India, shellac had traditionally been used primarily for wood finishing, coloring, and in the production of jewelry. One of shellac's first uses in the West was in the European hat industry, where it stiffened the felt in formal hats like the bowler, but at the same time gave them a malleability such that the hat could adapt its shape gradually to the contours of the wearer's head. The demand for shellac increased during the decades around the turn of the century, due, of course, to the nascent industry of recorded sound. Emil Berliner's first gramophone discs were made of hard rubber, but his employee Fred Gaisberg made sample records from shellac after he learned that the Newmark Duramoid company was making buttons with the material. These were judged to be superior to rubber, and Berliner switched to the shellac mixture in 1896. Shellac had a number of properties that made it congenial to record production. It required only moderate temperatures and pressures to shape it. It held a stable and accurate molding. It combined well with various fillers and pigments, and manufacturers could rework the scrap into the production process. Due to these qualities, shellac became the key ingredient in most phonograph records, although the particular recipe used by each company was a closely guarded trade secret. The fact that shellac was difficult to standardize, meant that there were fluctuations in supply and occasional shortages, particularly during World War I. The phonograph industry was thus eager to find an affordable synthetic substitute. Shortages during World War II gave new urgency to that search for a synthetic substitute. On April 14, 1942, the United States War Production Board issued Conservation Order M109, which forced record companies to consume only 30% of the shellac they had used the previous year. To make matters worse, the Japanese Army took control of several shellac-producing areas in Asia, slowing exports to the West. Strong incentives for developing alternatives continued after the war, when price controls were lifted and the cost of shellac rose to a prohibitive level. It's not surprising, then, that RCA Victor introduced its first transparent ruby-red plastic discs in 1945. RCA Victor's discs were made of a synthetic compound of petroleum and chlorine called polyvinyl chloride, PVC, or vinyl for short, which was marketed commercially by the Union Carbide Company in the 1930s. Peter Goldmark, the CBS researcher who played a central role in the development of Columbia's long-playing records, wrote that he'd been looking for a smooth, hard material to replace shellac and found it in vinylite, which had been used primarily in the manufacture of garden hoses. It's easy to see why the industry saw vinyl as an improvement over shellac. Vinyl was lighter and tougher than shellac, and so was considered to be unbreakable. The sturdiness of vinyl had come in handy during World War II, when the material was used to produce V-disc records for the armed forces, some of which had to be dropped to soldiers by parachute. Vinyl was harder and finer than shellac, and so allowed for more grooves to be pressed onto a disc, hence the material's importance for the development of long-playing records. All of these facts made it self-evident that the introduction of vinyl records signaled a change for the better, one of the many signs that post-war consumers were entering an era of better living through chemistry. But in my last part of my talk, I want to maybe think about that in another way. The defining moment in the birth of the modern environmental movement, Rachel Carson's 1962 expose of the chemical pesticide industry, was a provocative challenge to that optimistic narrative of better living through chemistry. And an eco-critical perspective emboldens us to question record industry marketing rhetoric that would have us believe that the undeniable benefits of vinyl LPs came without any significant costs. Vinyl is generally made from petroleum, which is a non-renewable resource. By contrast, shellac is a renewable resource, given that the forest ecology that supports it is allowed to regenerate faster than the rate at which it's consumed. The shift from shellac to vinyl records thus speeds the depletion of non-renewable fossil fuels. Where shellac is non-toxic and even edible, PVC has been called the most environmentally pernicious plastic in use, due to concerns that it causes cancer amongst factory workers and releases deadly chemicals like dioxin into the food chain. From the perspective of recycling and reuse, the fact that vinyl is unbreakable is a weakness, not a strength. Scraps of shellac were reused in the production process, and old and broken shellac records were returned to dealers to be melted and remolded during 1942 scrap drives during the war. By comparison, less than 1% of PVC is recycled, and products made from vinyl are difficult to repair, and so are typically discarded instead of being reused. This has implications for landfill, and non-biodegradable plastics like PVC account for around 18% of the volume of municipal waste. In 1945, a writer for Billboard magazine wrote that the new plastic LPs were, quote, ageless copies of the music that the family wants to keep forever. The statement was correct but incomplete, since the ecological implications of producing millions of indestructible Mitch Miller LPs were not part of the discussion. Columbia Records unveiled their 33 and a third RPM vinyl LPs at a 1948 press conference that presented a new form, the new format as a lightweight means of storing more sound than was previously possible. In its coverage of the event, Life magazine ran a photograph of Columbia's Peter Goldmark standing beside an 8-foot-high tower of old-style record albums that weighed over 300 pounds. To demonstrate the benefits of the new format, Goldmark held in his arms the equivalent amount of recorded sound in vinyl, a 1-foot-high, 30-pound stack of LPs. This industry-choreographed photo opportunity made use of the same kind of rhetoric that is used to portray recent digital devices as thin and lightweight and cloud-based services as offering limitless storage space for dematerialized music files. Then, as now, the issue is not as simple as triumphalist industry marketing might suggest. For green marketers concerned with the life cycle analysis of consumer products, the greenest devices are often those that reject the miniaturization that leads to thoughtless disposal and overconsumption. If we look more closely at the case of the vinyl LP, we can see how the rhetoric of lightweight media formats and bountiful storage space might encourage the escalation of consumption and obscure a number of significant ecological problems. Finally, vinyl records were part of a post-war revolution in sound technology and were hailed for their lack of surface noise and stunning increase in sonic fidelity. A century of industry advertising has made it seem natural to base qualitative judgments about recorded sound on the faithful reproduction of a source event and the absence of noise. Sound fidelity, however, is only one possible criteria for assessing sound recordings. The impurities of shellac were often caused by material traces of the trees and insects that produced the bioplastic material needed for sound reproduction. The pops and hisses of green discs can be heard then, not as noise to be eliminated, but as an eco-positive attribute of shellac, literally the voice of the kusum trees and reddish insects that provided a material base for the voice of Caruso. I hope that I have demonstrated that there were a host of hidden ecological costs associated with the introduction of unbreakable, lightweight, long-playing, high-fidelity vinyl records. Moreover, an eco-critical perspective reveals the particular material benefits of shellac. For those and other reasons, the green disc era should be revisited and appreciated, not as a form of antiquated material culture or an archive of outdated performance styles, but as an alternative model for new eco-ethical modes of capturing and consuming sound. Thank you.
Thank you, Jacob.